We've been doing a red letter study for some of the new faces that I see out there. The red letter study is going through the words of Jesus. And they are the words that are sometimes printed in red ink in certain editions of the Bible to set them off. And so we are in the middle, actually we're two-thirds of the way through the Sermon on the Mount right now. So that's Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And kind of took a little bit of a detour last week because Frank and I had just gotten back from the silent retreat and it had stirred up enough stuff off the bottom of the aquarium that I just had to talk about it, you know. But getting back into the text, I'm aware that these are messages over the last few weeks that have been difficult to try to convey. You know, I stay up late on Saturday anyway, putting the message together, but I've been staying up even later trying to figure out how I can get certain things across, because they're difficult. They're difficult concepts that we have. And Jesus talks about being born again. And there's a reason that he uses that phrase. He talks about using a child as the example of kingdom. And there's a reason that he uses that image. And the reason is that the spiritual life, the spiritual journey, kingdom, as Jesus calls it, and for those of you who are first time here, kingdom as Jesus defined it is not a place. It's not heaven of the next life. It's the quality of life that's available right here, right now, when we are present to the moment, aware of God's presence in the moment, aware of the connection between each of us and Him and His Spirit and all of creation. Those moments, that characteristic way of living life that incorporates a sense of humility, a sense of dependence, a sense of vulnerability, a sense of being okay with our imperfection, all of those attributes as listed in the Beatitudes, that attitude toward life, that experience of life, is what Jesus calls kingdom. The journey to that way of life is what we call the spiritual journey, spiritual formation, the spiritual life. But the problem is that that journey is unlike any other journey that you'll take. Completely different than what we think of in any way that we go about acquiring something that we want in life. The normal way that we go about striving to go out, doing what we need to do, setting a list of tasks before us, milestones, benchmarks, and going out and acquiring something in life is exactly the opposite of how we acquire kingdom. And I hate to use that word, because in reality, when we have entered into this way of living life, we are kingdom. We don't possess it. We don't own it. We don't inherit it. I know all those phrases are used in Scripture, but properly understood from the first languages, the original languages, is that we become. Jesus says, "Let the children come to me, for such as these are kingdom." It's the way he looks at us when we have crossed this line, characterized ourselves by living with this attitude and this spiritual sense of dependence and connection. So trying to get that across is difficult, because it flies in the face of everything that we think we know, everything that we have used all our lives long, to good result, often. It works. This stuff works in the physical world. So trying to turn that around and look at another way of living life is really difficult for us to do. Now imagine that most of you are here because you are looking for, maybe you call it a deeper walk with God. Maybe you call it a deeper connection. Maybe you call it the awareness of the God of our understanding. You can call it whatever you want to, but you're here for something more than you have experienced before. Something that dog really wants. I don't know. He's after something. You know, it's funny because a lot of churches, the reason for being in church, the reason for going on the spiritual journey is to acquire heaven. To avoid hell, to acquire heaven, to be saved is the way that that's mostly understood. To spend eternity with God in this place called heaven. And that's an easy thing for us to understand. Because heaven becomes the reward for a life well done. Heaven becomes the reward for following the rules, for obeying, for doing everything that we're supposed to do. But the problem with that is, it's easy because it doesn't require us to be born again. We understand those rules. As children, we were taught those rules. We know we are good, we get the reward, we get the cookie. Later on in life, we work hard, we get the reward. Now if we work hard, we get heaven. We understand those rules. No readjustment required. But if we're really looking for that deeper awareness, if we're really looking for this kingdom that Jesus is talking about, then those rules don't apply. We cannot get where Jesus is going, where he's leading, where he's begging us and beckoning us to follow by playing by those rules. Something else completely is required. And it's hard to get that across. It's hard for anybody to do that. When I had time to read on the retreat, one of the books that Frank had said that he wanted me to read was a book called Everything Belongs by Richard Rohr. And I got, I think, two or three chapters in. I didn't have a lot of time. But what struck me was right at the beginning of the book, he has this little section. I want to read it to you because it so perfectly captures exactly what I'm talking about here. The difficulty of trying to get through to ourselves, through our head, through our worldview, the otherness, the alienness, if you will, of the way that Jesus is showing us how to live. He writes, and it's titled Inherent Unmarketability. He's talking about his book, Inherent Unmarketability. How do you make attractive that which is not? How do you sell emptiness, vulnerability, and non-success? How do you talk descent when everything is about ascent? How can you possibly market letting go in a capitalist culture? How can you market letting go in a capitalist culture? How do you present Jesus to a Promethean mind? Now, for those of you who are not up on your Greek mythology, Prometheus was one of the Titans, one of the old gods, and he was the one who is credited with creating man out of clay and also for bringing fire to man, which allowed civilization to flourish, and then he was punished by the gods later on for doing so. But here in the West, Prometheus has become a symbol for us, a symbol of that striving, that scientific striving for excellence and for domination and for understanding and rational, you know, purity and all of those things. And Richard is asking, how do you present Jesus to that kind of mind, to that kind of worldview, to that kind of attitude toward life? This Jesus, who was a servant to all, this Jesus who wasn't afraid to be vulnerable, this Jesus who washed our feet, this Jesus who would let everything go, even his own life, in order to serve those he was with. I didn't come to be served. I came to serve. That is not honored in our culture. How do you sell Jesus to a Promethean mind? How do we do that? How do you talk about dying to a church trying to appear perfect? Always putting that face on. How do you do this? And he finally says, this is not going to work. Admitting that this might be the first step. How do we do this? You know, what fills churches today is usually finding power in God. There's nothing wrong with that. But we're looking for power in God that will vanquish our enemies, fix our circumstances, right the wrongs on that macro scale. We're looking for that to happen. We come to church and churches are filling up because they're looking for us to be lifted up to some sort of perfection, to armor us against all vulnerability so that just goes away, to create prosperity, to create wealth. If we do this thing, if we obey, then the wealth and the prosperity will be ours. In other words, our churches are filling up in order to feed that Promethean mind, not to try to change and turn our attitudes and our worldview to truly be born again, to really see life, our identity, our connection with God's Spirit through the Father's eyes and not through the eyes of Prometheus. You know, it's a difficult thing to do. We are so ingrained in this way of thinking and this way of traveling that we naturally just put a Christian veneer over the same attitudes and nothing changes. But if we really take time, if we'll really dig deep, if we'll really see what Jesus is trying to get across to us, it's something completely different, something completely other, something powerless, something vulnerable, something that admits dependence, something that is not trying to dominate Niagara's gold. Here's my Al-Anon coming out. But even here, you know, there's even here the effect. As much as we're trying to do this, there's an inherent problem. Some of you who are old enough might remember a man named Marshall McLuhan back in the 60s. He was a philosopher of communication theory. I see one head going up and down over there. Yeah. And he is credited with coining the most famous phrase of his career, which is the medium is the message. And what he was saying is that the study of media, the study of communication, is not so much the content, but the medium through which it travels. Is it television? Is it movies? Is it the printed word? What is it? Because that colors and shapes the message. And so here we are in this room trying to convey things through a medium that is shaping the message in a way that is antithetical to the message itself. It's so hard to do this. And probably the best way I can explain this to you is another, you know, great mind, Leonard Sweet, who is a Methodist pastor. He came up with this idea of EPIC, E-P-I-C. And he was trying to explain how the youngest generations among us are processing information. And it's an acronym. E stands for experiential, P for participatory, I for image-based, and C for communal. And he said, our youngest people are processing information this way. And think about it. You know, if you are going to, if a young person, you know, let's say a millennial or somebody, you give them a cell phone, do they go and pull out the manual and start reading through the manual? Or they just pick up the thing and start punching buttons. You know, forget about the manual. See, old school, the modern era, for the last 500 years, has not been experiential, it's been propositional. We propose a truth. We lay it out there. Here's the owner's manual. Here's the propositional truth. You got to read it, you got to study it. The kids among us are bypassing that completely, and they go straight to experience. They don't want to know the theory. Just let me do it. Let me get my hands on it. You know, the participatory part, the opposite of that in the modern world is being representational. Well, guess what we're doing in here? I'm being representational. I'm sitting up here, you're out there in your neat rows, sitting and listening, and I'm representing a propositional truth. I'm trying to get this across to you. Go to a concert where young people are. Go to anything where young people are, but especially a concert. The audience is as much a part of the show as what's going on stage. They're jumping, they're dancing, they're running up. They're part of everything. They're participating in everything. They're not just sitting quietly and listening. And image space, that's pretty obvious. I mean, there are so many fewer words in our media today. I mean, look at commercials, look at everything. The words are going away, everything is image, 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 image. Just fast cuts. You know, we're all about words. You look at websites from maybe just 5 or 10 years ago, and they were all word-based. Now it's all images with very few words. Kids go right to the image. And communal as opposed to individualistic. You know, kids are interesting because they are getting more and more individualized because of personal electronics. They got their earbuds on, you know, they got their headphones on, they're in their own little cocoon electronically, but they are completely connected also at the same time through all this social media. And so it's the community is layered upon the individuality that technology makes possible. It's a fascinating thing. And so it's so difficult for us as a church using the propositional, representational, word-based, and individualistic style or medium to convey something epic to our young kids. But here's where the light really went on for me. Those who wrote the Bible were epic too. Those who wrote our scriptures were experiential, participatory, image-based, vision-based, dream-based, and communal. And so we're trying to read a book that is epic through a mindset and a world that is anything but. So how do we get this across? How do we bring this through? You know, life is experienced epically. The spiritual journey is epic. It's not propositional. It's not intellectual. We can't read a book, even the Bible, and just figure it out. The Bible shows us how to live experientially, how to participate in our moments. How to interpret all the images that are just thrust upon us every moment of our lives, and how to connect with each other in community. The Bible, the word preserved in the Bible, is only as good as our willingness to take it out into the streets of our lives and live it. As Moses said, the law was not meant to be followed. It was meant to be written on our hearts. There's a difference. It's an epic journey that we're taking. And no matter what is said here, no matter how hard I work to try to convey certain things, until you take it out into your lives and experience it, participate in it, it will not change anything about the way you view it. You can't be born again until you experience the good news that Jesus is talking about. And it starts to change. You begin to trust the fact that the Father is exactly who Jesus said he was. But there's so many things that stand in our way. So many things that block us. You know, I got to tell you, when I started this journey, my personal journey about 25 years ago, I spent the first 10 years banging away at this intellectual door, trying to understand, trying to get the answers that would just break it all open for me. Marion can tell you, you know, the first six of our years of our marriage was the last 6 years of this 10-year period. And I was just as crazy at the end of that 10-year period as I was at the beginning. Now, Marion would tell you I'm just as crazy now, possibly. And she'd probably be right. But I'm less neurotic. I might be crazy, but I'm less neurotic. Because 13 years ago, I finally was able to understand that the journey is not what I thought it was. It's a completely different experience. Jesus is trying to explain this epically. Take a look at these passages in your bulletins, and TJ will put them up. And listen between the lines. Now, having given you this intro, what Jesus is really trying to say. At Matthew 13:44, he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again. And from joy over it, he goes and sells all he has and buys that field." The kingdom of heaven is like what? If we look at that through the Promethean mind, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Or maybe we just think of it in a commercial, transactional sort of way. Oh, yeah, yeah, this field is valuable. I'm going to go sell everything and I'm going to bring it back. Jesus is pointing to something else, something deeper. The man's realization of where the treasure is causes him to experience something, to do something, to participate in something, to sell everything he has and come back and buy the field. We're going to come back to this one in a second. Look at Mark 10:21. This one is the final punchline of the story in which a rich young man comes up to Jesus and says, "What must I do to obtain eternal life?" And he says, "Well, what has your youth told you? What has your life told you? Follow the commandments, but I've been doing this ever since I was a child. You know, but there's one thing you lack." Jesus says, looking at him, Jesus felt a love for him and said to him, "This one thing you lack, go and sell all you possess and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." Here's this lesson about selling all you have. But this goes much deeper than material possessions. It's just the one thing that this man was clinging to, that he was holding on to, but he needed to let it go in order to be able to follow Jesus. We're studying the Desert Fathers and Mothers on Wednesday night in the studies there. And there's this one great story where a young man comes to the elder and he says the same thing. "What must I do to get closer to God?" And the elder tells him, "I want you to go to the cemetery and insult the dead." Okay, so he goes to the cemetery and he insults the tombstones. And when he's done, he comes back. And the elder says, "Did you go to the cemetery?" "Yes." "Did you insult the dead?" "Yes." "And what did they say?" "Nothing." "Okay, I want you to go back to the cemetery, and I want you to praise the dead." He does it, comes back. "You know, did you praise them?" "Yes." "Did they respond?" "No." When you can react to the praises and insults of men the way the dead do, then you will be coming closer to God. It's a laying down of everything that we think we are. It's a laying down of the things that we hold dear. It's a laying down of the conscientiousness and the self, you know, centeredness of thinking that everyone is looking at us and thinking things, and we're trying to preserve our invulnerability and our perfection in their eyes. To lay all that down is to remove the blockages, to sell all we have so we can buy that field, is to remove everything that blocks us from the purity, the single-mindedness of this journey. And then the one that we read last week at Luke 14. "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Talk about laying down all we have. Talk about selling everything you have. Your very relationships, your family. In that culture, everything that gave you sustenance, everything that was your survival, was your family. Outside of the family, you were as good as dead. And hate here, of course, in the Aramaic, sana, means to preserve less. You know, it doesn't mean to hate maliciously, but to prefer less. And then he goes on. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. To accept your vulnerability, your own mortality, your imperfection. To lay down your life for something that is greater than yourself. And finally, anyone who does not give up all he has cannot be my disciple. Jesus is like a laser beam pointing to something that we have to get if we really want to be his disciple, which means if we really want to follow and go where he goes and experience this kingdom. Because what he's telling us is that this spiritual journey is not about learning. Not the way we think of learning. It's not about acquisition. It's not about going out and acquiring something. You know? That just feeds the Promethean mind. What it's really about is unlearning. It's about shedding layers of things that constantly are blocking us, giving up everything that we have that stands between us and the true nature of this journey. He's telling us to stop striving. He's telling us to let go, let die all those things that stand in our way. This spiritual journey is not like any other journey you take. We can't apply those rules, those ways, and get anything but absolute frustration and a hoarse voice, praying for things that God says we already possess. We need to let go. How are we doing on time? I wanted to read you a story, and it's a little longish. So 5 minutes it'll take me to get through this. I know. But it's the perfect example of what Jesus is trying to talk about. And it was actually written maybe 250 or 300 years before Jesus' time by a Chinese philosopher named Chuang Tzu. But just get comfortable for a second. You can even close your eyes if you want to. And just listen to this story and see if you can pick up these themes. I'm not trying to turn you into Taoist or anything. It's just that sometimes hearing it in another tradition brings out exactly what Jesus is talking about. It's called King's Disciple. And a disciple complained to King. And he said, "The eyes of all men seem to be alike. I detect no difference in them. Yet some men are blind. Their eyes do not see. The ears of all men seem to be alike. Yet some men are deaf. Their ears do not hear. The minds of all men have the same nature. I detect no difference between them. But the mad cannot make another man's mind their own. Here am I, apparently like all the other disciples, but there's a difference. They get your meaning. They put it into practice. I cannot. You tell me, I hold your being secure and quiet. Keep your life collected in its own center. Do not allow your thoughts to be disturbed. But however hard I try, the way is only a word in my ears. It does not ring any bells inside." King Sun replied, "I have nothing more to say. Bantams do not hatch goose eggs, though the fowl of Lu can. It is not so much a difference of nature as a difference of capacity. My capacity is too slight to transform you. Why not go south and see Lao Tzu?" The disciple got some supplies, traveled 7 days and seven nights alone, and came to Lao Tzu. Lao asked, "Do you come from King?" "Yes," replied the student. "Who are all these people you have brought with you?" The disciple whirled around to look. "Nobody there. Panic." Lao said, "Don't you understand?" The disciple hung his head. Confusion, and then a sigh. "Alas, I have forgotten my answer." More confusion. "I have also forgotten my question." Lao said, "What are you trying to say?" The disciple, "When I don't know, people treat me like a fool. When I do know, the knowledge gets me into trouble. When I fail to do good, I hurt others. When I do good, I hurt myself. If I avoid my duty, I am remiss. But if I do it, I am ruined. How can I get out of these contradictions? That is what I came to ask you." Lao Tzu replied, "A moment ago I looked into your eyes and I saw you were hemmed in by contradictions. Your words confirm this. You are scared to death, like a child who has lost father and mother. You are trying to sound the middle of the ocean with a 6-foot pole. You have got lost and are trying to find your way back to your own true self. You find nothing but illegible signposts pointing in all directions. I pity you. The disciple asked for admittance, took a cell, and there meditated, trying to cultivate qualities he thought desirable and get rid of others which he disliked. 10 days of that. Despair. Miserable, said Lao. All blocked up, tied in knots. Try to get untied. If your obstructions are on the outside, do not attempt to grasp them one by one and thrust them away. Impossible. Learn to ignore them. If they are within yourself, you cannot destroy them piecemeal, but you can refuse to let them take effect. If they are both inside and outside, do not try to hold on to the way. Just hope that the way holds on to you. The disciple groaned. When a farmer gets sick and the other farmers come to see him, if he can at least tell them what is the matter, his sickness is not so bad. But as for me, in my search for the way, I am like a sick man who takes medicine that makes him 10 times worse. Just tell me the first elements. I will be satisfied. Lao Tzu replied, Can you embrace the one and not lose it? Can you foretell good things and bad without the tortoise shell or the straws? Can you rest where there is rest? Do you know when to stop? Can you mind your own business without cares, without desiring reports of how others are progressing? Can you stand on your own feet? Can you duck? Can you be like an infant that cries all day without getting a sore throat, or clenches his fist all day without getting a sore hand, or gazes all day without eye strain? Do you want the first elements? The infant has them. Free from care, unaware of self, he acts without reflection, stays where he is put, does not know why, does not figure things out, just goes along with them, is part of the current. These are the first elements. The disciple asked, Is this perfection? Lao replied, Not at all. This is only the beginning. This melts the ice. This enables you to unlearn, so that you can be led by the way, be a child of the way. If you persist in trying to attain what is never attained, it is the way's gift. If you persist in making effort to obtain what effort cannot get, if you persist in reasoning about what cannot be understood, you will be destroyed by the very thing you seek. To know when to stop, to know when you can get no further by your own action, this is the right beginning. He's saying exactly the same thing that Jesus is saying. Do you hear the pieces of it? Do you hear how it rings? A couple things. He says, trying to cultivate qualities he thought desirable and get rid of others which he did disliked. 10 days of that, despair. Striving for perfection, it's what we all do. Trying to fix things. It's the Prometheus mind at work, going after something, trying to fix it, trying to evacuate all the things that we don't want. Abstinence, this, that, thou shalt not. But it's not getting us closer to what Jesus is trying to get at. And Lao replies, if your obstructions are on the inside, do not attempt to grasp them one by one and thrust them away. It's impossible. Learn to ignore them. Letting go, selling all you have, stepping aside from the thing, not giving it more energy by focusing on it. Sometimes we see the devil under every rock. All we're doing is giving him more power in our lives. If we focus on the Lord and ignore the devil, he atrophies. He becomes inconsequential in our life and our attitudes. If they are within yourself, these obstructions, you can't destroy them piecemeal, but you can refuse to let them take effect. In other words, we can choose a different response. In recovery, we're always talking about contrary action, opposite action. We are triggered to do the usual thing. Can we make another choice? Simply make another choice without understanding why. Just make another choice. If they're both inside and outside, do not try to hold on to the way. Just hope that the way holds on to you. Admitting our powerlessness, that first step. Allowing ourselves to be dependent on a power greater than ourselves. This is the beginning of the way. He says, I'm like a sick man who takes medicine that makes him 10 times worse. Just tell me the first elements and I'll be satisfied. Do you remember Philip asking Jesus exactly the same thing? Jesus, just show us the Father and that will be enough for us. You can almost see Jesus smacking his forehead. Philip, how long you been with me, huh? And you still don't understand? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It's experiential. It's not propositional. I can't give you information through your mind that will change your life, that will take you to a born-again experience. You must live it. You want the first elements? The infant has them. Free from care, unaware of self, he acts without reflection, stays where he is put, does not know why, does not figure things out, just goes along with them, is part of the current. These are the first elements. This spiritual life is not a going out and grabbing, it's a pushing off, it's a letting go, it's a selling all, it's an acceptance of the way things are in this dynamic between us and our God. If you persist in trying to attain what is never attained, if you persist in making effort to obtain what effort cannot get, if you persist in reasoning about what cannot be understood, you will be destroyed by the very thing that you seek. How many of us have beaten our head against that wall for so many years that we just feel completely lost, despairing? It must not be for me. Other people seem to get it. I can't get it. I'll tell you, after 10 years, that's exactly how I felt. You got to know where to dig, or we're just digging holes. Got to put the X over the treasure so that our efforts actually yield something. It's not that we do nothing in the spiritual life, but it's different than the way we do the other things. To know when to stop, to know when you can get no further by your own actions, this is the beginning. This is the born-again experience. To see what Jesus is trying to tell us, the true nature of our God is such that we can be dependent, vulnerable, imperfect, and it's all right. We don't need to erase those things in order to be acceptable. To understand that we are already acceptable through God's eyes, to see life through God's eyes, to see ourselves through God's eyes. That's this experience. That's what Jesus is trying to get us to, because then we can relax. Then the truth can make us truly free of all of this obsessive, compulsive, dysfunctional behavior that keeps us running, keeps us going. And as long as we continue to treat life as a task, one with means and ends, we'll continue to be frustrated. Because the truth is, life is not a task. It doesn't have an outcome that's neat and tidy, that we can just point to and work to and then it's all done. Life doesn't resolve. Life is all means, all process. We have to learn to love the process, and then everything starts to change. Because if we are approaching life as a task, then we're always approaching life from a place of need, a place of want, that something is not present in our lives that we must go find. And Jesus says it's not like that. Luke 17, the kingdom is not out there. You're not going to find it by observation. Here it is, there it is. The kingdom is within, among, in the midst of. It's already here. We keep striving for things and praying for things that we already possess. That's what Jesus is trying to tell us. The nature of God is that everything the Father has is already ours. If we can flip that over, instead of approaching life from a place of lack, approach it from a place of abundance. That in this moment, everything is already here. Everything is already present. All we have to do is take away everything that blocks us from seeing the true reality right in front of us. So think back on that passage, Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it, he goes and sells all he has and buys the field. What's the primary truth there that Jesus is trying to get across? Before the man goes out to sell all he has, he already knows where the treasure is. He's not seeking it. He knows where it is. All he has to do is let go of everything that keeps him from buying the field, keeps him from just immersing in the abundance and the gift that the Father has already given him. If we don't realize that we already know where kingdom is, where the spirituality is, then we'll constantly be striving for something, going in a wrong direction, looking for something that we lack, but it's already here. If we're always thinking that the kingdom is somewhere over the rainbow, then it will always recede from us like the end of the rainbow. Always looking in the wrong direction, starting from that place of lack. Now, in these last couple of chapters, Jesus has been constantly telling us not to worry and not to judge. Why is that? Why is worry and judgment such a difficult thing, such a blockage to everything that we're trying to achieve? Because worry is always coming from that place of fear, from that place of lack. It projects us out into the future that we need to get something that we don't currently have. And it takes us out of the only source of connection with our God that's possible. Worry does that, occupies our mind, projects us out, fear-based. We're worried we're not going to get something that we need. Judgment separates us from the connection that we have in the moment because there's some standard in our mind that we think that we need to meet and others therefore need to meet as well. Judgment is coming from the fear of punishment, the fear of not measuring up, not being acceptable. We have to work to strive to achieve something. Both take us out of the moment, take us out of the connection that's possible in the moment, take us out of kingdom. And they're both fear-based as opposed to love-based because only perfect love can cast out the fear. Jesus is telling us, stop seeking and start selling. Stop looking for something you don't have and let go of the things that block that knowledge that you already do. Now you're probably going to ask me, but didn't Jesus say to seek and you shall find? Yeah, didn't he? Well, what about that? And that's the next passage that we want to look at, the one that's actually in line in the Sermon on the Mount. At Matthew 7, 7 and 8. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receive, and he who seeks, finds. And to him who knocks, it will be opened. Well, it certainly sounds like Jesus just knocked all the wind out of my sails, huh? Isn't that exactly the opposite of what you just said, Dave? Now, come on, Pastor Dave. If you take a look at this passage in the Aramaic and you go back to the original understanding of these phrases, another reality starts to present itself, which is why I love going back to the original language. The word there for ask is selu. Selu is related deeply by roots to selah. You can hear it in the two words. They share all the same consonants. Consonants were the only letters that made up a word in Hebrew or Aramaic. And so they share the same root meanings. Selu is to ask, but it's like a police interrogation. It's an intense questioning. It's an intense desire or craving for something. And it's related to selah, and selah means to pray. But to pray in Aramaic, the understanding is that you quietly and patiently clear a space. And it's related to a hunting term where the hunter would go out into the forest and clear a space and set a snare for the animal and then cover it over with the leaves and then retreat into a blind and wait patiently, breathlessly, expectantly for something to happen, for the prey to come. Selah, which you'll find often see, you know, separating sections of the Psalms. It's a time to lean in. It's a time for the body language actually changes. You're expectantly waiting, listening, every nerve on a hair trigger for something to happen. You see how it's related to this asking? The asking here is not a simple petition, not just a prayer, please Lord, give me something. It's an intense craving or desire that takes us to a cleared space, a space that we have opened up, watching for something to happen, watching for the arrival of the thing that we're looking for, which takes us to the seeking, bea, which is to search diligently from inside to outside. And that's the key. The search is from inside to outside, not out there someplace, not trying to acquire something, but to literally leave no stone unturned inside, to make a passionate commitment to move forward and open up our lives and to see everything, to make the inside match the outside, that sense of integrity. Sometimes in recovery we talk about the committee, the inside committee. Does the inside committee match the outside committee? Is there integrity between those two things? That's huge in Hebrew thought. So the be'ah is to search to make the inside match the outside, to bring the two together, driven by the asking, the selu, that passionate desire, which takes us to the knock, koshv in Aramaic, which is related to kadash, which is the word for holy. Holy means to set something apart for a specific purpose. And so it's interesting that koshv, related to that, literally means to pitch a tent or to strike a note, a musical note. And when I read that the first time in the lexicon, it's like, what in the world is going on there? How does that relate to knocking? But the idea here is that when you pitch a tent, you create that space for something to happen. A family can now live there. Life can flourish there. When you strike a note, now everyone can hear what was it formerly just in your head. That sound, that richness is now available for everyone. The idea is that you make manifest something, make it real in that space where it didn't previously exist. What Jesus is talking when he says ask, seek, and knock is exactly in concert with everything that we've been talking about. Because it's not an imperialistic Promethean kind of going out and seeking and acquiring something and bringing it home to the place where it didn't exist before. It's the craving, that desire, that deep desire to search inside and outside until something is manifest and made real in our lives. That was always there. It always existed. The kingdom is within. God's spirit permeates everything. You cannot get away from it. It precedes you wherever you go. But our ideas about ourselves, our illusions about life, our concepts about how we get things that we need block us from the reality that is present to us all the time. We cannot see the unseen world that Jesus is trying to make real to us if we hold on to these false notions of how things work in our lives. Do we have enough passion, enough desire to be'ah, to release, to let go, to turn over those rocks, to see them for what they really are, the illusions that block our progress toward our God? If we don't, if we won't, if we can't, we're still loved. We're still saved. But right here and right now, we won't experience the koshv. We won't experience the reality of kingdom and everything that that means. There are two questions that every one of us as a human being has got to answer for ourselves, or our lives will always be random with respect to our choices, will always be some level of frustrating. And the two questions are, who am I and why am I here? Because it all comes down to identity. Who are you? Who do you think you are? When Jesus was asked that question, he answered in the only way he could, brilliantly, I and the Father are one. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I don't do anything that the Father doesn't do through me, that he hasn't shown me, that he hasn't done first. There is no daylight between us. His identity was firmly one with the Father. He prays that we will be one with him as he is with the Father. That identity is what this journey can teach us if we're willing to let go, sell all we have, shed all the things that block us from the knowledge of who we really are. Because who we are cannot be answered in isolation. It can only be understood in connection with the ultimate reality that we call our Father in heaven. When we know him, we start to know ourselves. And once we start to know who we are, then we know why we're here. Our behavior, our purpose flows out of us like living water. We don't have to obey anymore. Not about obedience. If you're obeying, you're going the old way. We want to flow out of us once we know who we are, why we're here. But we have to let go of this false self. The programs for happiness that we have built up over 20, 30, 40, 50, 70, 80 years, doesn't matter. Those programs need to be let go. And every time that we realize that we're doing it again, like that rich young man, Jesus is telling us, will you sell everything you have and come follow me? Can you do it? Will you do it? Are you ready now? When will we be ready? That last thing that we're clinging to, are we finally ready to let it down, let it go? This journey won't feel like any journey that you've ever been on. It doesn't feel like learning. It doesn't feel like acquiring. You know what? It just feels like living your life. You just live your life moment by moment. But at some point, if you really will continually be free to let go of all of these things, to admit your powerlessness, your dependence, your vulnerability, your imperfection, and realize that it doesn't matter, that when you open yourself up completely to another in the moment, you're still just as connected and just as loved, and in fact, you finally feel that connection maybe for the first time. If you can do that as you live your life, at some point you'll realize you're actually starting to enjoy the ride. And then you'll know the kingdom journey has begun in you. And Jesus is smiling from ear to ear. Let's pray. Father, it's just like you to make this thing so simple that a child can do it, and at the same time so difficult that it eludes the most intelligent among us. I'm almost praying for us to be less intelligent, but that doesn't sound right. So, Father, help us to step away from what we see as our gifts right now. Our intelligence, our talents, our good looks, our assets, whatever it is that we see as our strengths, help us to step aside and just let them be. And to go into a small, quiet place like a child, looking up at the elders in our life who are life to us itself, and just be. Help us to be dependent. Help us to understand that's who we are. Help us to let go. Help us not to hang on to things that are only blocking us from you. Help us to see life through your eyes. We want to see through your eyes, Father. We want to be completely born again and to realize what that means, not just for the first time, but every moment of our lives, every day of our lives, to see it again and again, how much more there is to see through your eyes. We love you, Father, because you first loved us. Thank you, in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand. Thank you.